Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is September 15th, 2020. And tonight we are saying, whoever wins, we lose. There is no lesser of two evils, just evils. Racism, sexism, classism. And we are dealing with an anatomy of colonialism and imperialism, which is an anatomy of an American capitalist system. And our program consists of updates from the political prisoner death camp. Our program consists of analysis of the political party system. Our program deals with oppression and how to overcome it. Tonight, we're going to say, Ralph Poynter, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us in our community, do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds, as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, we've heard this over and over again, but let me be very clear as to how we can participate in this struggle. All of us can participate in this by supporting our political prisoners. And I remind you again, our political prisoners are those who understood what was happening in America, did something about it, are punished, are in the death camps, and we must support them. And in supporting them, we will participate in the liberation struggle that they started. Now, we've said this evening, and no matter what, no matter who wins, we lose. We, meaning the people of color. One more time, we as voters are being bamboozled. And those who propose that we vote for the Democratic Party have a logic that goes somewhat like this. Kamala Harris is a black woman, and we should vote for her based on that. And they dare use the name Fannie Lou Hamer as an example. They remember what she did, and they forgot what she said. She said, "We were ready for freedom," meaning the people who were struggling to get the vote, the people who faced death, who faced lynching, who faced terror in their communities, were out working for the vote, not for the vote. They were using the vote for freedom, and we must remember that. The vote was a tool to get something, and so they risked death to gain this tool. And so Fannie Lou Hamer said, "We were ready for freedom, but the black loyalist Democrats were not." Well, who are the black loyalist Democrats? You know them. Nothing has changed. There was another black woman who said, "Any change without power is only temporary, for it can be taken back." I think that was Zora Neale Hurston who said that. And proof that it can be taken back is Brown versus Board of Education. And there was so much excitement at Thurgood Marshall's winning of that case, and Brown versus the Board of Education. But the schools are more segregated today than they were then. And the people who talk about Kamala Harris as a black woman, they forgot the support that Cynthia McKinney earned and didn't get when she ran for president on the Green Party ticket. They forgot Biden's role in the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas incident. They forgot an awful lot. Or maybe they just don't want to know about that. They want to live on false hope where there has been no progress shown. And so what we do here is that we try to educate people in any way we can. We try to bring information that will direct people's actions towards improvement. And above all, we try to support those souls, those wonderful souls, the finest among us, who cared about their fellow citizens and defended them in the way that they have to be defended. And when I say defended them, I'm talking about us. I'm talking about the people of color, the people of poverty, the people who had no chance to move forward or up. And so those brothers and sisters who felt and loved the people and fought and did something about it are in the death camps. And who can deny the need for self-defense? And in the news, I'm sure you have all seen the person running up to the police car, the army of occupation, and firing. And at the police station, the headquarters for the army of occupation, the crowds gathered around to chant about the two members of the army of occupation who were in serious condition. The crowd shouted, "I hope they die." Now, what is that about? Is that about cruel people? That's about angry people who are sick of the news that some person of color with seeming little or no excuse was shot dead, running away from a moving violation, running away from a vehicle situation, or not running away, being home in their bed, being home out of bed, and no charges, year after year, in increasing numbers. How much are a people expected to take without a reaction? Well, many of us are not going to take that action. Many of us are not going to react in that way. What way can we react? And I say to you again and again and again, if the government does not respond to the people in a manner that the people want responded to, then the people should not respond to the government or the political party. Now, when this happens, that the government does not respond to what people want and express, then it is no longer democracy. It's something else, as people have been telling you, have been telling us, over and over again. It is something else. It has never been democracy. So, one of the things that we know, that 65 to 70% of the people are vocal about nothing negative, only a common positive response of the government, and that is a national health care, because without it, we are in such terrible shape. And in this pandemic, the person running on the Democratic Party line said if a national health care comes across his desk, he will veto it. And yet there are those saying we must vote. We must support the negative, because something more negative is out there. And I say to you, the more negative is out there and has always been there, and the person in the White House didn't create it. He just thrives on it. He just talks about it. It has always been there. He can't create it. He can't stop it. Only we can stop it and take the first step by understanding what it is and what it has always been and the one of the reasons for it. There are several reasons, and if we study man's inhumanity to man, we will see some of the various reasons for it. But once again, I have been told I've been speaking too long. I hope maybe to come back at the end of the program. But, Sister Betty, the microphone is yours.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. We have an amazing lineup tonight. We have a member of the African People's Socialist Party coming back to visit with us again, Dr. Aisha Fields of Project Black Ankh. And one of the things we should know is that on behalf of the AAPDEP Medical Advisory Team, they're going to be, and she will be discussing a project called the Black Ankh Community Supporter Program. It is our response, it's the people's response to emergencies like COVID-19, to emergencies like Ebola, to emergencies like, how about malaria? How about sickle cell? We have an answer. We are our own liberators, to quote Jalil Montekin. There is something you can do. There is a response that you can make that would be the proper response, an anti-colonialist response. And so shortly we will be calling on Dr. Aisha Fields. But before that, we want to go to Sister Ann Lam. Because as you know, if you've been paying attention to the Jericho website, Cuomo, even though COVID threatens many New York prisoners, Cuomo, the Democrat, still refuses to conform to our demands to let our people go, to free our warriors, to free the aging political prisoners, to free the aged population in New York City and New York State. So without further ado, we want to turn the mic over to Sister Ann Lam, who will bring us up to date on our prisoners, our captives, both the political prisoners, warriors who raised up a fist against oppression, and those who were victims of poverty and police law and order, such as the bills that were passed by Mr. Biden in 1984 and 1994 that created the biggest prison population for black people that's even larger than the slavery, the count for slavery 400 years ago. And I want to remind people that one of our political prisoners is Dr. Matula Shakur. And what was his crime? He believed in using acupuncture to cure drug addiction in Harlem. So without further ado, we're going to open up Sister Ann's mic, and then we will hear the wonderful, astute, courageous Dr. Aisha Fields. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Lam.
Yes. Hey, Ralph. Hey, Sister Betty. Always an honor to be with you. Thank you for reminding us about Mr. Biden and those laws. Yes, it's a really nasty thing. I'm going to be brief, but I do have just received this really amazingly horrible news, not about a political prisoner, but about our friends who are really our political prisoners, all our immigrant friends being held at ICE facilities. But before I do that, I would like to say, just so people know, our friend Jalil Montekin went to the board on Friday. He had two commissioners. So we're waiting to hear what the results of that are. So that's all I can really say about it at the moment. But that did happen. That was the de novo hearing that Kathy Manley fought for and received. So we'll see what happens with that. We are also starting in between my friend Margie, who works with Philly Anarchist Black Cross Federation, and myself. We'll be starting a fundraiser for Sister Joy Powell. Now, Joy Powell is directly a political prisoner due to her very effective work against police brutality in Rochester, New York. And what have we been hearing about in the past week? Rochester, New York, right? So not anything new. And she was framed up and convicted of a murder that she did not commit because of her effective police brutality work. And she is working on trying to overturn her conviction. So this fundraiser will be for legal expenses. She has retained an attorney who specializes in this, and we will be raising money to bring that case to court. Now, I just got this news today from Claude Marx at Freedom Archives. Now, we remember the forced sterilization of the Puerto Rican women, right? We remember the forced sterilization of Native women, right? We remember the forced sterilization of mental patients, right? Now we have forced sterilization of immigrants. This is like, I was like, this is so horrifying. A staggering number of hysterectomies are happening at an ICE facility, whistleblower says. And this was at vice.com, and Claude forwarded out on his listserv. A whistleblower complaint filed Monday by several legal advocacy groups accuses a detention center of performing a staggering number of hysterectomies on immigrant women, as well as failing to follow procedures meant to keep both detainees and employees safe from the coronavirus. The complaint, filed on behalf of several detained immigrants and a nurse, courageous nurse, named Dawn Wooten, details several accounts of recent jarring medical neglect at the Irwin County Detention Center in Ocilla, Georgia, which is run by the private prison company LaSalle South Corrections and houses people incarcerated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. In interviews with Project South, a Georgia nonprofit, multiple women said that hysterectomies were stunningly frequent among immigrants detained at the facility. When I met all these women who had surgeries, I thought this was like an experimental concentration camp, said one woman, who said she'd met five women who'd had hysterectomies after being detained between October and December of 2019. The woman said that immigrants at Irwin are often sent to see one particular gynecologist outside the facility. It was like they're experimenting with their bodies, she said. In one case, Wooten said, a woman who ended up with a hysterectomy was not properly anesthetized and overheard the doctor say that he'd taken out the wrong ovary. That woman had to go back and get her other ovary removed as well, Wooten said. We questioned among ourselves, like, goodness, he's taking everybody's stuff out, said Wooten, who was a full-time nurse employee at Irwin until July. That's his specialty. He's a uterus collector. I know that's ugly. Is he collecting these things or something? She continued. Everybody he sees, he's taking out all their uteruses or he's taking their tubes out. What in the world is happening? Wooten also said she talked to several detained immigrants who'd had hysterectomies but didn't know why. One detained immigrant told Project South that, ahead of the scheduled procedure, she was given multiple different explanations about what would happen and why it was necessary. While ICE reported in August that 41 immigrants at Irwin have tested positive for COVID-19, Wooten believes that the true number may be much higher, according to the complaint. Women housed in multiple units in the facility allegedly exhibited COVID-19 symptoms, but were not tested for the virus for weeks. Immigrants have also allegedly continued to be transferred in and out of the facility against guidelines by the Centers for Disease Control and the advice of Irwin's own medical director. The complaint also alleges that both the detained immigrants and staffers at Irwin lack the personal protective equipment they need to stay safe during the coronavirus pandemic. People in both groups have only received one mask each since the pandemic broke out. So these people have received one mask since March. It is also impossible to socially distance within the facility. There is no way to protect against COVID-19 at all here in the facility, one immigrant said. We share everything together. There is no way at all we can feel protected here in the facility. Detained immigrants also said that the medical and quarantine unit in one part of the Irwin facility were filthy. One woman said she had to clean her cell using shampoo because staffers wouldn't give her any cleaning chemicals. She recalled seeing another woman use her socks to do the same. If it wasn't for my faith in God, I think I would have gone insane and just break down and probably gone as far as hurting myself, the woman said. There are a lot of people here who end up in medical trying to kill themselves because of how crazy it is. Some men at the facility even went on hunger strike, demanding to be released or to have better protections against the coronavirus, but nothing changed. Meanwhile, employees are also expected to work even if they have COVID-19 symptoms and are awaiting their test results. And management at the facility also allegedly refuses to tell officers if any detained immigrants have tested positive for COVID-19. Right? This is just great, isn't it? Which could heighten their risks of contracting the virus. Ms. Wooten explained that she believes ICDC is hiding information about COVID-19 in order to keep things quiet. She stated that everyone in the facility is scared at this point, so management does not want to tell officers and detained immigrants the truth because they're afraid of an uproar. Instead, the secretary has created a silent pandemic where even if officers get COVID-19 from the facility, the officers won't be able to blame ICDC because no one knows how prevalent COVID-19 is inside. So, because they're not testing immigrants and they're not sharing who has the virus. Besides Project South, the advocacy groups Georgia Detention Watch, Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, and South Georgia Immigrant Support Network helped file the complaint with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General. Lauren Klein published the complaint after The Intercept covered some of the allegations and cited. LaSalle Corrections didn't immediately respond to a Vice News request for comment. In the past, the Irwin County Detention Center has repeatedly been found to be in compliance, I'm in shock, with ICE's detention standards. In a statement, ICE said it does not comment on matters handled by the Office of the Inspector General. And here's their little quote, which really is disgusting. ICE takes all allegations seriously and defers to the OIG regarding any potential investigation and or results. That said, in general, anonymous, unproven allegations made without any fact-checkable specifics should be treated with the appropriate skepticism they deserve, like as if all these people are lying, including the nurse, a former employee of theirs. That's not anonymous. Anyway, I just thought that was so disgusting and horrible that it really needed to be exposed because, you know, this is something that is not included in the UCL Law COVID-19 Behind Bars project. The immigrants are not included in that. So, you know, you can imagine how many more cases there are than what we already know of, the more than 1,000 confirmed deaths of people throughout the prisons, jails, and federal prisons in this country. More than 1,000 people have died. More than 1,000 people have been de facto sentenced to death. And if we add in all the people in immigration detention, it's probably at least twice that, if not three times. So, you know, this is really disgusting. These people are literally being sterilized. If you have a hysterectomy, you can no longer have children. If this is not genocide, I don't know what is.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. We do know that imperialism and oppression is the same everywhere, using the same tactics. Only the names are changed, and it protects no one. Thank you for that, Ann.
The names are changed in order to protect the guilty, Ralph.
Without further ado, we're going to move right along. I see a number of people we must have reports from. I see our brother Mark Pessin from the People Pueblo Party. We must hear from him. I see our journalist, Sister Dolores, in the wings. We've got to hear from her. And we have a special guest, and I see Sister Gwen is back with us. So we're going to move around real quick. Now, the next speaker, as I anticipated for you, is Dr. Aisha Fields. And Sister Ann, when you were talking about the sterilization project, she had a successful women's clinic in Sierra Leone and in America. And while in America, the infant mortality rate in some of our areas, like in New York City, the Fort Greene Project, 70%. Dr. Aisha Fields did not have statistics like that. And she's here to tell us about a program that we must get behind, that we must support. Dr. Fields, thank you for getting on, and please, your mic is open.
Uhuru, everyone. I really just want to appreciate Sister Betty and Brother Ralph for allowing me to have a few minutes on your program, and I really want to appreciate the report that just came from the Sister Ann. It just, to me, it reminds me that this system has to go, and that the people of the world won't know freedom, you know, until it's in the dustbin of history. And I just really want to, appreciate that report being at the top of the program. And just to say that, you know, my name is Aisha Fields, and I'm the International Director for the All African Peoples Development and Empowerment Project, or APDEP for short. And that is an organization that was established by the African People's Socialist Party. I'm also a member of the National Central Committee of the African People's Socialist Party as the APDEP director. And we were established by our party in 2007 as a way to organize African people. And when we say African people, we're talking about black people, anywhere we might exist in the world, to organize us to be able to contribute our skills in agriculture, in education, in healthcare, into a process that will help us to create concrete community programs in those areas, but as a part of a revolutionary strategy to win self-determination and self-government for African people. It's an anti-colonial community development organization, you know, that doesn't see charity as being a way forward for African or any colonized person, but recognizes that self-determination is the key to overturning all of the conditions that have been imposed on us. And so this evening, what I kind of wanted to share with everybody is one of our most, I think, important initiatives. Sister Betty spoke about, you know, in her introduction to me, you know, one of our previous programs, which was an infant and maternal health program in Sierra Leone, where we focused a lot on helping to provide training to traditional birth attendants and nurses and midwives, and creating centers to be able to offer African women safe spaces to deliver their babies, and creating a network of the traditional birth attendants, midwives, and nurses to be able to, you know, help to improve the outcomes. And through that particular process, we helped to deliver more than 3,000 babies without death of one mother or child. And that's in a community, well, in a country where 1 in 12 women at that time were in jeopardy of dying during childbirth. And so part of what we've done over the years is really try to create programs where African medical, you know, professionals can, you know, can contribute to increasing, you know, our ability as African people to control our own health, create our own independent health care system, our own independent health care program. And one of our programs that we're really in the process of really building right now is our Project Black Funk program. It was initiated in Sierra Leone in 2014 in response to the Ebola epidemic, and we began to build it as the African nation's response to the Red Cross, as a humanitarian aid and emergency response organization that could, you know, constantly training African communities on how to prepare itself for natural disasters and other emergencies, and developing, you know, specialized teams that could potentially, you know, go out to respond to natural disasters and other emergencies that happen in the African world, and that it would be African people's very own, you know, essentially Red Cross kind of styled organization. And so we initiated that in Sierra Leone in response to the Ebola epidemic. Did some, I think, important work around that. But it's in this era, COVID-19, that we've recognized the significance of, like, really making this a permanent program of APDEP. And so what we've done is we've established an international telehealth program, which has allowed for African nurse practitioners, doctors, and other medical professionals to volunteer through our Project Black Funk program to offer free COVID-19 information, education, and support for African people. And anybody is free to access it, but our target is African people, you know, anywhere in the world. And so we launched, we did a soft launch in July. We have since July, you know, taken appointments from various countries in Africa, Sierra Leone, South Africa, in the UK, in France, and in various states in the United States. And what we really are in the process of doing now is really trying to talk to everybody we possibly can about this program, about this free resource. And we recognize that African people have been hardest hit, not only in this country where, depending on what statistics you're looking at, where we can be something like 3.8 times more likely to contract and die from COVID-19 than other people. In the UK, African people are 4 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people in the UK. You know, Brazil, the country that has the second highest number of African people in the world, just behind Nigeria, you know, is number 2 right behind the United States in terms of COVID-19 infections and deaths. South Africa is number 5, you know, so, you know, and even though Africa hasn't been as hard hit right now, you know, with the weak infrastructure that Africa has, and even in various parts of the Caribbean, you know, should this virus take hold, it would really be devastating for our people. So this is a free resource, absolutely free resource, that that any African person or any person anywhere around the world can access. You can have access to our volunteer medical professionals who are there to help to support our people in this period, help us to get, you know, through this COVID pandemic. And we just really want to invite people to make an appointment. If you've yourself have COVID, or if you have COVID symptoms, if you are caring for a loved one with COVID, if you just have some questions, you're not sure, if you're trying to develop a plan for how to keep your family safe, maybe you're you know, you work in a high risk job, and things you might want to talk through to make sure that you can create a plan that will help to minimize the risk to your family. If you've already recovered from COVID, but you're still experiencing certain kind of symptoms, and you want to be able to have some support in trying to figure out, you know, a plan for how you can manage those symptoms, you know, those are the kind of things that our telehealth program is set up to do. And in probably the next couple of months, we're going to be able to also offer free mental health support through this program. You know, we really want to encourage people. You can make an appointment and get a free appointment by going to our website, which is developmentforafrica.org. And then you to our booking page, where you can make an appointment. All of the appointments are in Central Standard Time. So, you know, just consider that if you have to make an appointment, that those are in Central Standard Time. You can make an appointment. It's a video conference. You'll meet by video with one of our, you know, nurse practitioners or doctors, and offer, you know, we offer whatever kind of support we can. So that's really what I want to share this evening, and I want to just, you know, make a call for people who may be medical professionals or who may have access, like Brother Ralph and Sister Betty, to other platforms that can allow us to get the word out about this free resource. You know, to you know, definitely consider, you know, connecting with us to be able to help us to spread the word more. If you're part of a community organization, I'm happy to send a representative to give a brief presentation about the program. And there's so many ways that people can connect and help us to make this available. Our people need it. It exists, and we just really want to make sure that, you know, that the word is out. So I really want to, again, I want to appreciate Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, for your support and for allowing me to have, you know, some time on your program to discuss. I want to thank everybody.
Mm-hmm. Please repeat how to get in touch with you for that help.
Thank you. So a couple different ways. If you just want some general information about the program or to make an appointment, you can go to Development for Africa Telehealth. So that'll take you straight to the page and tell us more about the program and where you can make an appointment. If you want to reach out, maybe email or phone, to be able to talk about maybe some questions you have or some ways you might want to connect, you can send an email at info@developmentforafrica.org, or you can call at 256-281-1344. 256-281-1344.
Thank you so much for that.
I want to remind people that you can go to that same link and make a donation. You can go to that same link and volunteer. We need more medical practitioners to volunteer. Any skill you have that you can make available with regard to media or technology, contact that number or that website. One of the things we must do is be our own liberators. One of the ways we can do that is by creating and supporting our own institutions. Finally, the six pivotal states are being wooed by Biden. And all I have to say to these people who are saying the lesser of evils, if you don't get your demands, what difference does it make? If it's too late for demands, if you don't know how to make him give you your demands, why should you vote? Why should any of us vote for Biden? And one of our demands, free our political prisoners. The second demand, a national health care bill. Thank you, Sister and Dr. Aisha Fields. Without further ado, we're going to move right along here. And Dr. Fields, before you go, I hope you will designate to some of your colleagues or anyone that represents your program to call in and give us updates whenever you feel it. We understand that you are coordinating this and you are very busy, and we commend you for the success you've had in the past. But please feel free to designate someone to call in from time to time and give us updates and to make an appeal. If they can pay for sneakers, if they can pay for their latest iPhone 11 or 12 or whatever they're up to now, they can make a donation to your program. We need a black Ankh. We need a black cross. Thank you, Sister. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Sister Betty.
All right. Remember, ain't too proud to beg, as the song says. Without further ado, we're going to go to somebody who we missed last week. Sister Gwen, your mic is open, and we're going to get an update from our journalist, Sister Dolores, after that. Sister Gwen, your mic is open.
3933, your mic is open.
Okay, we will come back to her. We will go to Sister Sorry about that. Trying to open up Sister Dolores' mic. Just give us a moment here. All right, Sister Dolores, pardon the delay. Your mic is open. Yes. And
can
we'll come back.
Me?
Yes, we can. We'll come back to Sister Gwen after Brother Mark.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I first want to mention that I read on the news today that Breonna Taylor's mother, you know, she filed a lawsuit after her daughter was murdered, and that the city of Louisville will be paying her several millions of dollars. You know, and she won her lawsuit, in other words. And they say that this will be the largest settlement that Louisville has ever paid to date. You know, so that's some kind of good news. And I'm going to give an update on the forest fires that are happening in California. And, you know, I mentioned previously about the prisoners who were fighting these firefighters. So Governor Gavin Newsom mentioned, I think it was yesterday, that the prisoners will get credit for fighting these fires. And he signed a bill which is giving them training credits for fighting the fires, and states that this will help them get jobs once they're released. So, you know, seeing is believing. Okay. I wanted to talk about Labor Day, because last week was Labor Day. And I was reminded of having heard many years ago about union hiring halls and their history of discrimination against black workers. And that, you know, the fact is that racial segregation is in virtually every area of life in the United States, also included the labor movement. And racial prejudices by white workers were visible and practiced both in the North and the South. So last week on Labor Day, I was just looking up this hiring hall stuff and the union discrimination against black workers. And I just made some notes about it. Racial segregation within labor unions highlights the issue of the African-American status in virtually every area of American life. The labor movement's democratic ideals has been in serious conflict with the tradition of racial discrimination in the unions. Union discrimination reflects the racial and religious prejudices among union members, prejudices that many unionists share with other prejudiced persons. In the North, groups of white workers participated in violence against black workers. And in the South, workers have given considerable support to the White Citizens Council and other groups seeking to perpetuate segregated institutions. But trade unions' discrimination against African Americans is something more than just a simple result of rank and file prejudices. To understand it better, there must be a distinction in the history of the American labor movement between economic and non-economic liberalism. Organized labor struggled for the right to bargain collectively, unemployment insurance, and minimum wage laws was a central part of the liberal program. But in non-economic matters, in such areas as civil liberties for political dissidents and equality of opportunity for racial minorities, the practices of many important labor unions can hardly be described as liberal. Many unions have a long history of racial discrimination, and it is this tradition of discrimination which is responsible, at least in part, for the marginal status that black workers, wage workers, have today in the key sectors of the American economy. There's a profound...
Continue.
There's a profound disparity between the public image presented by the national AFL-CIO with its professed devotion to racial equality and the day-to-day experiences of many black workers in the North as well as the South with individual unions. There are important exceptions, particularly in the mass production industries, where a large concentration of black workers actually preceded unionization. Such unions as the automobile workers, the United Packing House Workers, and the Rubber Workers Union have consciously worked to eradicate institutionalized job biases. But some trade unions practice either total exclusion of black workers, segregation in the form of Jim Crow locals or auxiliaries, or enforce separate racial seniority lines, which have a limited black employment to menial and unskilled classifications. So in the South, unions frequently acted to force African Americans out of jobs that had formerly been considered theirs. In urban centers, the African American who, before the Civil War, performed all types of labor, skilled and unskilled, but he found himself gradually almost eliminated from those various trades. Unionization in the South often led to redesignation of African-American jobs, quote-unquote, as white man's work, quote-unquote, and even to excluding African-Americans from entire industries. In the North, most of the time, they effectively kept Negroes out of skilled work. The fact that the AFL, as such, was officially against racial discrimination did not mean much because the Federation didn't do anything to check racial discrimination exercised by its member organizations. The AFL's failure to organize the black worker and to accord him full brotherhood within the union ranks was not a policy born out of necessity. The industrial unions in the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, they were able to organize black and white workers together in the North and in the South. However, early on, the AFL attacked the organizing activities of the CIO among the unskilled and Negro workers. So just to add a little more, there was little evidence that the AFL leadership in the early part of the 1900s gave more than occasional lip service opposition to racial discrimination within the union member movement, within the union movement. In cases where black workers were refused admission to an affiliated AFL union, the Federation adopted a policy of organizing them into separate locals. And this policy was sanctioned by the AFL Constitution, which stated that separate charters will be issued to central labor unions, local unions, federal labor unions composed exclusively of colored members, and stating that it appeared advisable and in the best interest of the trade union movement to do so. So early on, the hostile feelings toward blacks in American trade unions often led to racial and ethnic violence. In East St. Louis, race-wise, in the year 1917, trade union provocation was a major factor. In East St. Louis, the white workers destroyed millions of dollars of property. They drove thousands of black persons from their homes, and this ended in the death of more than 200 black people. And this was like 4 years before Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, race riots by whites. So the East St. Louis AFL Central Trade and Union Labor Union called on its members to march to City Hall to demand a halt to the importation, quote unquote, of blacks into the city. The immigration, they called it, of the Southern Negro into their city had reached a point where they stated that drastic action had to be taken, and they demanded that the city council take some action to retard this growing menace and get rid of a certain portion of those who were already here. So there's a newspaper, one of the newspapers in St. Louis reported that there had been a series of sporadic violent attacks against Negroes, which culminated in the Holocaust a few weeks later. And that's the word they used, the Holocaust. And it was also reported in another newspaper that Negroes were flushed from burning houses and ran for their lives, screaming and begging for mercy, and that the rioters just stood around in gangs, laughing and cheering while the Negroes crawled to the streets to die after their flesh had been cooked in their own homes. And shortly after the riots, another newspaper quoted the opinion of the president of the Central Trades and Labor Union in St. Louis as stating that the tenseness of the situation needs to be relieved, so employees must convince the laboring whites that they will be given preference over imported blacks in applying for work. There's just a couple of more things. After decades of continued inability of the AFL-CIO to curb discrimination in its ranks, the black worker turned to governmental agencies and to the courts for protection. In several cases, discriminatory unions had invoked a legal doctrine of quote-unquote voluntary association to justify the exclusion of Negroes. And so black workers, you know, they had placed so many of their hopes in the courts and in the state and local fair employment practices, because organized labor seemed incapable of overcoming its habitual discriminatory practices. On the level of the small shops and local unions, the traditions of discrimination have often been institutionalized, and the psychology of many of the white workers were that these positions were white men's jobs to which no Negro should aspire. And these workers, and often their union leaders, regarded jobs in their industries as a kind of private privilege to be accorded and denied by them as they see fit. So the inertia which sustained discrimination was found among skilled workers in big industry in the North almost as commonly as in the South. I read that the very AFL-CIO leaders who opposed bias in other institutions were reluctant to combat it within the labor movement. They feared that any militant decision to ban discrimination, no matter how gradually it was applied, would split the AFL-CIO wide open and thus weaken the so-called liberal cause. For the black man seeking employment, union discrimination was a cruel fact. Because the unions controlled the hiring process and the apprenticeship programs in the building trades, the printing trades, on the waterfront, on the railways, and in so many other industries. And just knowing about all of this, you know, the American labor union today, it's such that union discrimination is a fundamental social barrier to the black worker, hardly less serious than segregation in the public schools back then. This is in the 50s. So there was a some locals originally defied the orders of the Fair Employment Practices Commission, but admitted a token number of Negro mechanics when confronted by widespread public denunciation. And so, you know, it's as Frederick Douglass stated, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. So, you know, now when I'm thinking about the UFT's current position with the kids returning to school this fall, I'm planning to follow it closely because, you know, in terms of their close relationship with the Democratic Party, you know, it's just that we have to keep a close eye on UFT. So anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about.
Thank you so much for that. Education, education, education. History, history, history. Wonderful. And we have extended the program. We're going on to 10:30. And so up next is...
Brother Mark, I think this is a wonderful segue for you. Brother Mark, People Pueblo Party, and an educator. Sister Dolores, thank you for that history. Amazing. And Brother Joel, hang in there. Brother Joel, you're next. Go ahead, Brother Mark. Your mic is open.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for inviting me again. And thanks, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph and the previous sister who gave a very important historical summary of some of the discrimination and some of the goings-on with the union and with the UFT. You know, the current president of the union has for a long time really scuttled union militancy. You know, I think that, you know, he inherited a power structure in the union that was used to destroy the community control movement for the schools. And, you know, the UFT wrote the law that decentralized schools, which set them up into local community boards on electoral districts so that the Democratic Party and its operatives could take control of those community boards. And, you know, at one point when it looked like parents and community people were actually going to take control of the schools, then they revert. Then they, the union supported the push for mayoral control, and so that's where we are now with mayoral control. And the union has been for a long time an appendage of Wall Street and big business in New York, you know, talking tough but doing very little to mobilize the rank and file, which is a much more diverse rank and file than it was in the 60s. And you could see it in the union leadership. You know, there are various or a number of Latino and African-American leaders in positions in the union, the UFT right now. But it's really a defanged kind of animal now, you know, and so when the union leadership threatened strike over safety issues, which are legitimate, absolutely legitimate, there are a lot of schools opening that should not be open. You know, if we look at what happened in Vietnam and Cuba with COVID, they really are trailblazers and really show us what's the right way to contain COVID, save lives, and to open schools and open up society. And none of that has been done here. You know, on paper, everything looks great, but it's a total mess. You know, there are a lot of schools with broken ventilation systems, systems that haven't worked in years, because the Democrats and Republicans, their number one thing is to feed more money to the rich, you know, through bailouts, through bigger and bigger defense budgets, or, you know, offense budgets, because, you know, they use all that money to bomb other countries and destroy people and to feed the prison industrial complex. So, you know, a lot of the rank-and-file education workers, not just the teachers, but many other workers, are, you know, taking matters into their own hands, working with parents, working with kids, working with the community, to really fight against this push from the mayor to get everybody into unsafe buildings. And, in fact, on this Thursday at 7:30 a.m., there's going to be an informational picket with parents, community people, staffs, students, pushing for the repairs to be made so that schools can be safe. And that's this Thursday, 7:30 a.m. at Westside High School on 102nd Street between Amsterdam and Columbus, right inside the Douglas Houses development. And there's going to be folks out there. They're going to gather at 7 a.m. and then they're going to start a program at 7:30 a.m. to really, you know, protest and to provide information about why the school building is not safe and why schools need to be safe. You know, the public schools in New York are a majority black and brown institution. Most of the students are black and brown students, over two-thirds. And it's really telling that, you know, they're being pushed, the staff and the kids and the parents, to go to these schools, which are completely unsafe. They're not ready. And so, you know, a lot of people are going to get sick and, you know, unfortunately die if we don't take the action we need to take. Kids are supposed to be in school starting Monday. And so this week is a big week for us to push for these safety measures to be put in place. And if they're not put in place, then kids need to be remote until, you know, these schools are safe. You know, it doesn't make sense to push kids into unsafe situations and adults as well. So that's kind of like a brief update in terms of what's happening in this. And you can see it in the news every day, the new cases. The students aren't even in the buildings yet, and there are new cases of COVID. So, you know, it's a big recipe for disaster, you know. And, you know, and de Blasio, you know, he talks a good game like a lot of Democratic liberal politicians do. And at the end of the day, they always have it out for us. They really, you know, set us up for failure. So, you know, I'm encouraging people to support their local schools, you know, and make sure that those schools are safe before kids go back there next week. So that's my brief report. And so thank you for the time. And, you know, we got to keep struggling. You know, as this empire, you know, more and more collapses and goes into decay, we have to more and more get better organized and more support each other and help each other get through this so we can create a better system, a system that will replace the hot mess that we're in right now. Thank you
so much for that, Mark Torres. You've heard in the last few minutes, yesterday, today, and we're going to have to do things for tomorrow. Next up,
Before we go to Brother Joel, I want to thank you, Brother Mark, of the People Pueblo Party. Only through unity against oppression will we win. And that's what the People Pueblo Party represents. 8863. You're new to our system. If you want to say a few words before we move to Brother Joel, 8863. Your mic is open. Did you want to say a few things? Last four digits, 8863. 201. 8863. Did you want to make an announcement or speak?
No, I'm just listening. Thank you.
Well, welcome. Thank you. Tell more people about the program. Without further ado, we're going to go to Brother Joel. Your mic is open. And we see we have Brother Gil in the audience and Sister Gwen is back. Thank goodness. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Yes. I haven't heard the beginning of the show. I was preoccupied with some work here, but I just want to refresh that last week I was talking about how the polarization of the country is at a very, very sharp point. And there are many instances now already where different types of right-wing militia types have come to demonstrations, Black Lives Matter, armed and organized and connected with the police. And there have been shootings, there have been assaults. Some of those have been fatal. And then what happened was that there was an apparent defense of the demonstration against the right-wing attacker, where the right-winger where the right-winger was the one that didn't make it through the incident. And it's instructive as to what's happening in the cases where the Black Lives Matter and other anti-racist protesters were assaulted or killed. Usually the attackers have been let off. There was one truck driver who plowed his truck right through a number of protesters, and the prosecutors just concluded that that was self-defense. And right now there's a Kyle Rittenhouse who killed two protesters and shot one. He drove in with a semi-automatic rifle from Illinois, he said, to protect property against the protesters. He ended up shooting two protesters, and right now his extradition is being held up based on a self-defense case that looks like it's going to at least delay or water down any prosecution. And in the case where the protesters fought back, the person that was accused police of having acted in that case, this time it was the right-winger who lost the fight, let's say. There was no self-defense option. There was no trial, no due process. The police surrounded him, and while he was in his car, they fired into his car. They claimed he got out of the car. They kept firing, and he was killed on the spot. And then Donald Trump, using the presidential puppet, got up there and he said, well, that's what needs to be done. These people, there has to be retribution for any of the acts of the protesters. There was no hint that he was acting in self-defense, although he had friends who he told that if he hadn't done what he did, this attacker was had a very, very long knife or sword and was coming at the demonstrators, and he felt that that they were subject to very serious danger. And Trump also has gone on the media to excuse Kyle Rittenhouse also, claiming that he was acting in honorable self-defense, in contrast to when things went the other way, where he's encouraging, and don't forget, this is in the context of his having invited to the Republican convention a couple who threatened demonstrators with firearms, and he was given an honored spot to address the nation. So there's a very big effort now to create stormtroopers. That is, they feel that combined with the police, are making violent attacks against the demonstrators. And by stormtroopers, I mean that just like in Nazi Germany or something, right-wingers and fascists and racists acting as freelance members of the occupation army, which the police has largely become in black communities. And of course, in Rittenhouse's case, the police were seen fraternizing with Rittenhouse just before the incident. And by the way, he was not arrested at the demonstration. He was allowed to drive back to his home in Illinois from Wisconsin, where the shooting took place in Kenosha, and he turned himself in. And as I say, his extradition now is being held up, and it looks like they're going to go to some kind of self-defense excuse for his having killed two people. It, very similar, by the way, to the Trayvon Martin case, where this guy was not even a cop, and somehow he provoked a confrontation with the demonstrators and then killed two and shot one more, claiming self-defense. He was armed, as I said, with a semi-automatic rifle that he brought in from Illinois, having driven 25 miles. It wasn't like he was reacting to an incident happening in his hometown. He was attacking the national uprising against the racism sparked by the George Floyd case and other similar cases in defense of the racist acts of the police, and not just police in general, but police at their worst, killing defenseless people, almost always of color, so this is the mentality that's driving it. And we all also heard today in the media that the head of the HHS, a Trump appointee, has been predicting that there will be a violent collision over the election. And he was urging Trump supporters to arm up and be prepared for an armed conflict over the election. That is hinting that Trump will try to stay in the White House and call out large numbers of right-wingers to give an armed self-defense of his really a dictatorial takeover. And I think it's very important for people to, people that are pinning their hopes on Biden, or at least to buy some time or something like that, to be aware that that the right wing is arming against someone as mild as Biden and the Biden campaign. And in the midst of in this entire context, it places a new significance on the election also, because even if none of that type of armed struggle breaks out, and even if Trump doesn't stay in the White House by starting a civil war, it still, at this point, would represent the statement that if Trump is held up as the winner of the election, representing some kind of an electoral majority or electoral college majority or whatever it is, it will be the impact that it would have would be that the it would be as if the people were making a collective statement. If the voting seems to go for Trump, in that context, it would be almost like I mean, elections have always been used to hide the true source of power, and this would be the way in which it would be held up to the masses and making a collective statement that that this is what they want or this is what they'll accept at least, and it's coming into a very dangerous situation. We wouldn't want that kind of a statement to be made in the name of the masses collectively, even though it would, of course, be a distortion and it would be in the midst of an election which is largely fraudulent on both sides, and in which people are being manipulated by the media into a certain scenario, and also in which the Biden campaign doesn't look like it's really fighting anyway. It looks like it's taking a dive. And
well,
the Democratic Party strategy seems to be to try to gain control of the Senate to rein Trump in to some degree.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for that intellectual and thorough report. We'll be looking forward to more of your reports. And I think it was Sister Lynn said 50 years ago, the reason why the feds and the state and the governmental institutions don't go after these right-wing organizations, because that's Brother Ed, Cousin Joe, Uncle Pete. And so that story is still true. Sister Betty.
All right, Brother Gil, your mic is open. And Sister Gwen and Sister Vivian, hang in there. And we see we got Brother Val back. Okay. Brother Gil, your mic is open.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about a couple different things. First of all, on the Mumia front, we're coming up now on two years almost. A couple months away from 2 years ago that six boxes of new evidence in Mumia's case were found, quote unquote, found in a storage unit by the new DA, Krasner, and released to Judge Tucker, who was hearing an appeal of Mumia's case at the time, based on the question of one of the Supreme Court justices failing to recuse himself on Mumia's appeal. So he was hearing that case, and then in the middle of the case, they discovered these six boxes of evidence, which is not in the chain of custody, case files, but in a storage room at the DA's office. So already, you know, kind of crazy situation. Anyway, based on that, we've been trying to have an appeal for Mumia's case. It's been 2 years now. Over the summer, the Supreme Court is hearing this King's Bench warrant to try to take the DA, Krasner, out of the case. Our own Mumia's own lawyers are locked out of what's going on, in terms of the delays associated with that, and also potentially taking this evidence out of the chain of custody controlled by the DA and Judge Tucker. in the meantime, we're not sitting on our hands. You know, we expect the legal system to be corrupt in Mumia's case and in the case of all political prisoners, as it always has been. So folks in Philadelphia are organizing in the 5th District to change Wallace Street between 7th and 8th Street to be renamed Mumia Abu-Jamal Way. We're trying to keep Mumia in you know, in the hearts and minds of people in Philadelphia, because, you know, they're really, as all of us are, want to know what's happening in this case, but really we can't report anything for the last 6 months because it's tied up in this legal mumbo-jumbo. Essentially, they're trying to suppress the evidence in his case. you know, people can contact Mobilization for Mumia if they want to get involved, but it's really mainly petitioning folks in that district to the City Council of Philadelphia. So we're concentrating on that effort right now, again, just to keep Mumia and the fight of other political prisoners, you know, on people's minds, you know, because people, you know, you can't tell them, oh, well, the case is tied up for the last 6 months, and they want to know what's going on. So the other news on the Uhuru front, we had Dr. Aisha Fields earlier in the show. I noticed I didn't hear all of the earlier part of the show because I was tied up in something else and came on the show late. I apologize for that. But I'd been on this show a couple of weeks ago, and the March for Reparations that we were planning here in New York is not going to be happening. Instead, we're going to be going down on the same date, October 17th, down to Philadelphia to join the March for Reparations. It's going to be happening in 6 cities around the country, and we decided to consolidate with the folks in Philadelphia. So this is Saturday, October 17th, which is, I think, about a month from now. I think a month and a couple of days. And we're going to be marching from the Liberty Bell at 6th and Chestnut to the Uhuru Furniture Store on North Broad, a little north of City Hall, just north of Ridge. You know, folks, if they want to come and join the March for Reparations, can contact the Uhuru Movement here in New York. I'll be on the show next week with more details about all that. But you can also support it. We're doing like a walkathon kind of thing on Fundly. And I'll, again, have all that information next week. Before I let go, I just wanted to talk about something else that's been going on. I don't know if it was discussed in the show, and if it was already, then you can let me know. But I just wanted to call attention to it. There have been charges for a while, and it's now bubbling up into a major brouhaha in Georgia at the ICE Detention Center, where there are charges of forced sterilization, forced hysterectomies, mass hysterectomies
earlier
going on.
Thank you for that, but we covered it earlier, Gil.
Okay.
It was
okay,
very
fine.
Well, and thank you for keeping
up
on it.
It's just something that we can't ignore, so I just wanted to bring it up if it hadn't been. So thanks.
Yes, thanks.
All right. Before we go to Sister Vivian and Brother Val, Gwen, we hope you're still there. Glad you came back. Can you give us a few words of wisdom? Okay, so looks like we lost her again. We're going to go straight to Brother Val and then to Sister Vivian.
Yes, good evening, everybody. I apologize for coming into the show late, and I also apologize for not having my notes in front of me, so I would just make a few comments. Some few months ago, right, actually pretty much just 4 or 6 weeks into the pandemic, there were several reports in educational journals in, actually illustrating, I guess beyond reasonable doubt, because they were actually policies that were formalized, wherein school districts around the country were allocated $165 billion, yes, that's with a B, like in boy, billion dollars, to handle the pandemic, even when the schools were closed, in preparation for, again, the schools are reopening. So it seems to beg, I mean, everyone seems to beg the question as to what are exactly are they doing with all those billions of dollars that were, again, you know, allocated in just the first 4 or 6 weeks, with several billions more expected as the pandemic continued. And now that the school year has begun, you know, one wonders you know, what exactly are the educational enterprises doing with all those billions of dollars, which in conjunction with the basic funding, you know, actually surpasses, exceeds, you know, the total amount that we've spent on defense in the present fiscal year. So again, you know, no one seems to be discussing as to why all those billions are not being used to safely open our schools. But again, you know, the reasons have, I think, already been touched upon by earlier speakers tonight, you know, in terms of, you know, who the pawns are, as usual, in this game, you know, all the expendable pawns, while the enterprise continues to be a lucrative operation, you know, with no questions asked by the media, who supposedly, you know, it was established to be part of the checks and balances. So that's just one observation that obviously needs a lot of, you know, contemplation, elaboration, and questions to be asked. On a different topic, and again commenting to one of the earlier speakers in terms of the settlement, you know, the landmark settlement, and I believe Louisville against the police department, we have to keep in mind, you know, this is just an initial announcement of a settlement, you know, as to what really, you know, comes out of it as the weeks and months, go by, and this news, this dramatic news fades from our daily conversation. You know, one past anecdote perhaps serves to illustrate what may actually come about from this again landmark settlement. If one recalls that in the early 2000s years, you know, the tobacco industry was slammed with again a landmark historic $550 billion fine, you know, by a jury after 22 state attorneys general, you know, sued them successfully. But keep in mind, even though that was an historic, landmark, unprecedented fine of $550 billion, supposedly to offset all the medical expenses incurred, you know, to cigarette smokers and, you know, and their costs in hospitals, a Judge Bush judge reduced that $550 billion historic settlement to just $1. You know, check that out. Check it. So let's not all be too, you know, happy and perhaps even optimistic about this current settlement that's in the news today, because, you know, who knows as to how these things actually, you know, end up in the long run. And again, it'll be out of the news after a few days. And another episode will obviously transpire, as seems to be the, you know, almost becoming the routine in our everyday life. And finally, you know, as one final observation, again, from my experiences and my, you know, monitoring of the situation because of my background, perhaps more than we need to fear from Biden is his vice president herself, you know, who was the leading force behind the incarceration enterprise again. So I'm going to leave you and my dear friend with just those three observations, comments, and I look forward to again returning with some more insights, perhaps in a better prepared way, than I was tonight because of my other distracted circumstances. But I really thank you all for giving me this opportunity to at least express myself and also to be a well-informed listener of this great panel. Thank you, and have a good evening.
Well, thank you so much for that. And as we say, education, information, and we look forward to our panelists coming back again and again with more information, and I'm learning.
Before we go to Sister Vivia Brooklyn, who's running, I want to read something from Mimi Rosenberg. She talked about a wonderful protest device. And you know Mimi's with WBAI, and she's broadcast all over Pacifica. And those of you who don't support WBAI, shame on you. Those of you who don't know about Black Agenda Report, shame on you. Those who don't know about Chris Hedges, shame on you. Anyway, Mimi Rosenberg from Take Back Discussions said, there's a wonderful billboard now in the heart of Times Square on 43rd and Broadway, directly across from the New York Police Department station. Well, It says, hey, NYPD, it's us, NYC residents, the ones who pay your salary. We pay $300 million to settle your lawsuits. You pay nothing. We need to talk. And without further ado on that note, we're going to go to Sister Vivia, and we want you to know, if you want candidates that support your demands, you got to start when they start. You got to support them when they need you the most. Sister Vivia, your mic is open, and with that, we're going to take it home. And all of the mics are open. We just want to thank all of you for education, education, education. Sister Vivia.
Good evening, and thank you so much, Betty, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. And I really want to say you're more than brother and sister. You're mother and father. So I want to say thank you for all the work that you're doing. And my organization, Friends of Wingate Park, we're doing a food and mask distribution on Monday, September 21st. At Wingate Park. If anyone, we have 200 boxes from Fresh Direct coming at 10 a.m. and we want the community who needs it to come out and get the food. So we're doing stuff in our community, and we hope that with your help we could get the word out and strengthen each other in more ways than one. And I just want to say thanks again. And, of course, I'm running for city council in 2021. My website is viviamorgan.com, and it's viviamorgan.com. And we're looking for volunteers and donations. And I want to thank you again for this opportunity, and I look forward to getting some support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Vivian. Remember this, Vivian Morgan, running for city council, is one of our people. We have had to get together and make sure that she makes it. It's getting late. We have to get involved. But thank you, everyone, for being on the program this evening. There is so much more to learn.
We want to remind you, Thursday, 7:30 a.m., Westside High School, 102nd Street between Amsterdam and Columbus. Come out and protest the death march of our children in these COVID-19 schools.
And remember to go to Wingate Park. Vivia, give us the time again.
10 a.m. on Monday. Wingate Park is located at the corner of Rutland and Brooklyn Avenue.
Okay, on the corner of Brooklyn and Brooklyn Avenue, 10 a.m., Wingate Park. Morgan, our city council. Thank you. And see you all next
week. All right. Thank you, Sister Gwen, Brother Joel, Sister Dolores, Brother Val, Brother Gil, and, of course, Dr. Aisha. And we can't forget the incomparable Brother Mark. Thank you so much, everybody. Come back next Tuesday. Remember, protest, struggle, resist, fight injustice. We are our own liberators. I wish I could live like I'm lost.